So am I still waiting, waiting a long time,
waiting for tonight.
Listen to review me.
Superstars.
15 SmackDown superstars in the same ring at the same time.
The Royal Rumble match, it only happens once a year.
It's every man
for himself.
There's gonna be some trouble tonight. A very Royal Rumble, that's right.
The match continues till only one man remains.
The winner with an eye on the prize.
Title shot at WrestleMania.
The main event at WrestleMania.
We'll step into the ring. We'll reach an understanding. Where the smoke is clear, I'll be the last man standing.
The Royal
and the stakes couldn't be any higher.
No bigger opportunity than the main event of WrestleMania.
The Royal Rumble that we'll never forget.
I'm gonna settle every score tonight. They'll take back every word they said tonight. I'm gonna show the door every saint or sinner. There can only be one Royal Rumble winner.
The road to WrestleMania has begun here at the Royal Rumble.
Well, it seems I'm calling.
Welcome, everybody, to Review Away. It's John Pollock, joined, as always, by Wei Ting for another edition of Review Away. And Wei, I've got to say, I'm very excited about tonight's episode, because not only are we going to be reviewing the 2005 Royal Rumble, but we are going to be joined by a guest. And when I say joined by a guest, it doesn't mean that you're just going to hear John Pollock interview somebody. No, John Pollock and Wei Ting are going to double-team Dave Lagana.
Oh, God.
Which will play into the opening question with Dave.
Wow. Well, okay. Yes, you're right, John. We are going to both interview Dave Lagana.
So I'm looking very forward to this, Wei. We won't lie. We've already done the interview with Mr. Lagana, and I thought it went very well.
I thought it was perhaps one of the best interviews ever done.
I really enjoyed this format. That with our studio here at the Fight Network now, we are progressing, and now we're able to do interviews with people in the industry. And yeah. I've always found that it always kind of enhances the review when you have people that were actually there or involved that can give us little stories. And the great thing about Dave is that he's got a fantastic memory for someone that 6 years on the WWE creative team. Can you imagine all the stories that probably occurred in those 6 years? Mm-hmm. And to be able to isolate events and remember specific instances, which I think fans of this show are going to get a kick out of after our review, hearing from Dave.
I completely agree. I just found it to be a – I mean, we haven't done this review yet, but I found it to be a great compliment to what we are about to talk about.
Yes.
It really – he's pretty a pretty invaluable resource.
Yes. So providing you guys enjoy the new format, we're going to make a big effort in 2011 to step up the interviews on Review Away to try and get guests. And who knows who will be stopping by. We're definitely looking for guests that maybe don't do as many interviews. There are some more obscure names out there, and that's what we were asking for you guys last month. We got some great suggestions, and me and Wei have kind of put a list together of people we want to go after in 2011 to try and have on the show. So we'll see how that goes. And we'll get into the review, because the Royal Rumble 2005, this was, from my standpoint, actually, was a very interesting time period, because it was just about 2 weeks before this that the Fight Network had come in and purchased Live Audio Wrestling. Mm. And I ended up watching this event with the original founders of the Fight Network at a bar in downtown Toronto. Wow. Before the law. And the thing I remember most was Jason Agnew having a gigantic eye problem where, I'm serious, something in his eye like exploded because he has these eye problems. God. And it was a broken blood vessel in his eye.
Oh, no.
And he watched this entire pay-per-view with like a broken blood vessel in his eye.
Because he had to do the law that night.
He had to do the law
that night.
He
couldn't go to the emergency room.
No.
Well, just like Vince McMahon, he toughed it out.
Yes.
And the show went on.
A great comparison. So let's get into it, everybody. I just wanted to share that story because that's what I recall with this 2005 Rumble. From Fresno, California at the Save Mart Center.
Yeah.
And why is that
Save
funny?
Mart. Have you ever been to a Save Mart?
No. Are they in Canada?
Either. I don't think so.
No. I know Strikeforce has run a few shows in this arena.
It just sounds like such a fake sounding.
Save Mart Center.
If I was going to make up a fake grocery store,
The Save Mart Center would be it. We open up the show, Way, with a video counting down from five with retro clips of the Rumble. And then it cuts into the Guys and Dolls parody. Is it Guys and Dolls or was it West Side Story?
I thought it was West Side Story.
It probably was. I do not know my musicals.
Me neither.
At all. At all. Yeah. So I'm not even going to pretend nor be offended if somebody corrects me on this. I do not
care. We'll wait for the Photoshop to tell us the answer.
Oh, yeah. So we got this parody video, which when it first aired, Way, just fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Fantastic commercial, which with so many pay-per-views, you don't remember any of the commercials. But this one stands the test of time, I feel.
I really enjoy this, and especially this, as well as the WrestleMania Goes Hollywood commercials that were to follow in the same year. Because they were fun, and they just showed that this pro wrestling company, pro wrestling is just, it really is a silly thing. It's just grown men play fighting and acting, and it's just fun, and that's all it should be. And these commercials show that they don't take themselves too seriously. All the characters are breaking kayfabe. They're all together, and they're just singing and dancing with stupid wigs, and it was just fun.
There was some terrible lip-syncing in this video, which I thought made it even better.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to be kind of weird throughout this show, but I mean, in this video, there was a big emphasis on Chris Benoit in the opening video and this, because he had won the prior year's Rumble. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there was going to be a lot of focus on him going into this one of can he repeat?
Yes. Is that the warning? Is that how we're going to warn everybody?
No, I'm just saying. There was a lot of Chris Benoit on this show. Yeah. I mean, the guy goes 47 minutes in the Rumble.
Okay.
So
that's to be expected.
Be warned, everybody.
Do you think we'll ever review that Royal Rumble, the 2004 Royal Rumble?
If you want to, I'm at this point, it was really weird when we first started doing the reviews and a Benoit match would come up and it's still odd to watch him wrestle, but I'm not to the point where I'm going to avoid watching something because Chris Benoit is involved.
I think we've all accepted it and we just can't avoid it.
Yeah. I don't care to get into the whole debate with people about his place in history, which I'm now bringing up. Nonetheless, that's the opening video, everybody.
Okay, yes.
Okay, so we've got Michael Cole and Taz, who are calling the show for SmackDown at ringside. They were still doing the separate locations for the announce crew with Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler up at the entranceway for Raw. And then we go into our first match, Edge and Shawn Michaels. Shawn Michaels is in the opening match of a pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. Ross calls Michaels a first ballot Hall of Famer, which was not the case for the Observer Hall of Fame, but was for the WWE Hall of Fame. And he brings up Michaels winning the Rumble in the same arena in 1996
Fresno. I'm just thinking about that. What other match could they have put on first? Because if you look at this card, there's a casket match and then world title matches. And
yeah, this was the best choice to put on. Mm. I had no problem with it. Some people will think it's weird when, you know, a big prominent performer or title match is in the opening match. I've never looked at the opening match as a kind of a demotion for a guy. I always used to love the opening match, and I think that comes from WCW, where that was always your action-packed match to set the tone for the show.
Yes, but it was always the action-packed match for guys that were never featured in your main event. What if John Cena was in an opening match?
I believe that would be fun. There was a WrestleMania where Cena opened up the show.
When he was a main eventer?
I think it was a title match. It wasn't a world title match, though.
Yeah, it was probably a U.S. title
WrestleMania
match.
20. Yeah.
Yeah,
so.
but anyway, Shawn Michaels is a Hall of Famer, legend, you know, a first ballot Hall of Famer, as Michael Cole said. And so
Jim Ross.
As Jim Ross says. But so I do agree with the skepticism sometimes about putting these guys in the first match. You want to build, you want to promote, and you want to save some of these stars for the end. But in this
didn't bother me in the least, but we'll get into things later. Edge comes out, and Edge looked gigantic next to Shawn Michaels.
Did he?
He looked pretty big in comparison. Edge gets the heat on the floor, driving Michaels back first onto the mat on the floor, and then follows up with a baseball slide. There was a sign in the crowd I spotted here that said, "Macho, we need you."
Macho, we need you. Oh,
and,
God.
And 6 years later, the video game would deliver him.
He actually came back to promote that action figure.
Yep. Yes, he did. Have you seen the promo for the video game?
I saw it without sound.
Well, then what's the use of that? The promo was the...
I just wanted to see if it actually, if it was real or if somebody just made it up. I just...
They wouldn't get an imposter.
Okay.
Edge gets... we then get a long sleeper spot by Edge. Mm-hmm. Michaels finally fights out and makes a comeback. Michaels then hit a slingshot onto Edge, who goes into the post and then is rolled up for a near fall. I've always loved that spot. I've always thought it's such a great near fall spot where the guy gets catapulted into the post. It's never a finish, mm-hmm. but it's always just everyone pops for that near fall.
At some point in this match, JR brings up how Michaels won the Royal Rumble here in 96.
Yes.
In Fresno. And Michaels references that. Well, I guess maybe he wasn't referencing it, but at one point Michaels skins the cat, and this was very similar to his finish. What was it in the was it in the 95 or the 96 Rumble?
He won both those Rumbles.
Yeah, but when Michaels actually, maybe I'm thinking my finish is wrong, but anyway.
Edge tries to leave the ring, but Michaels brings him back. The referee then tries to get Michaels back in the ring, and it leads to Edge spearing Michaels on the floor, but Michaels makes it back by the count of 9. Then Edge does this really lame dance, and he starts teasing his own sweet chin music, but ends up hitting another spear for a 2 count, and then Edge pulls his hair out. Like, a clump of his hair is pulled out here. Yeah.
Really?
It's an odd spot. This was a point where Edge, they were trying to make him a heel, and he was in that level where... No one loved him as a babyface, and no one hated him as a heel. Mm-hmm. He was just there.
Mm-hmm.
And sadly, it took sleeping with Lita to get him over as a heel.
Yeah.
Which, in truth, that is what really pushed him to become a top heel.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, the guy's a great worker, but he didn't have that reaction from the audience at this point, I found.
So it was the best thing he did for his career was to sleep with Lita.
Yep. Michaelson hits an elbow off the top. Crowd was really into the match at this point. Michaels then finally gets to his feet, calls for the sweet chin music, but Edge counters as he goes for the sweet chin music and hits an electric chair for a 2 count. Then Edge puts on a variation of the sharpshooter submission. How would you describe this way?
Well, it's called the Edgecator.
Is that one?
Yeah.
That was the other thing about Edge. His finishes awful. Were puns like...
Edge-o-matic. Education.
It's so bad.
The Education.
Oh.
The Educator.
Yeah, sorry, the Educator.
It's called an inverted sharpshooter.
Okay,
that's
thanks.
What they called it.
But Michaels made the ropes here. Then Michaels goes for an O'Connor roll, or a rolling crotch hold for you Japanese fans, but I know people are going to just laugh at that name. It's countered by Edge, who rolls him up, grabs the ropes, and gets the pin on Shawn Michaels. So theoretically, a big win for Edge here. And they got almost like 19 minutes here to open up the pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. This was a good match, I thought.
Yeah, it was good. I wasn't really grabbed by anything here until the near falls. And I got to say, maybe perhaps because this was featured in the spot that it was, maybe because I didn't follow this build.
Could have been. And they got a lot of time. They had the time to have a really great match. Yeah. But at the same time, do you want to have such a giant match to kick off a show.
Yeah.
That's not really the position to have the blowaway match of the night.
Yeah.
If you're putting together this as a whole, this show. Eric Bischoff's backstage with Teddy Long. At this time, Bischoff was the general manager of Raw, Teddy Long from SmackDown. And he's telling Long that match proved why Raw is better. There were a lot of factors that proved why Raw was better. And he's in the room with Christy Hemme and Tori Wilson, whose job tonight, Way, was to spin the Royal Rumble balls inside of a what would you call it? A
I'm sure there's a real name for it.
They use them in bingo. I don't know what it's called.
Ball cage.
The ball cage. That's gross. Then Ric Flair and Eddie Guerrero walk in, and I just knew this was going to be a great segment if they did nothing else but pick their numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Flair chooses his number and he sells it like it's great. Eddie then picks his, and it looks like it's a terrible number. So Eddie congratulates Flair. They hug, and while Flair doesn't realize it, Eddie takes Flair's ball and switches it with his own. And Flair then looks at his number. He shows it to everybody, and then he turns it around, and he is not happy. Mm-mm. Because he realizes what's been done here by Eddie Guerrero.
I really like this. I really like the whole This set of vignettes.
At this point in time, they were doing the individual brand pay-per-views. So they only did four shows a year together. Mm-hmm. And I always looked forward to the vignettes because you'd get guys interacting that you'd never see interact.
Yes.
And they were really well done. And then when they put the rosters together for all the pay-per-views, you kind of lost that.
Exactly. And we got to see gems like what we're about to talk about right now.
Oh, John Heidenreich is in a locker room talking to himself about hating caskets and breathing heavy. And then Gene Snitsky walks in. Heidenreich's on SmackDown at this point while Snitsky is a Raw guy. And Snitsky's got taped ribs and a black eye after he was chokeslammed off the entrance ramp in Toronto, by the way. And both don't like caskets. Then Gene says he likes John, though. John says he likes Gene. Then they breathe heavy. And I noted this was creepy. And I think we owe it to our listeners to play this vignette.
Caskets. Caskets. I hate caskets. Caskets. I hear you don't like caskets. Mike, I don't like caskets. I hate them. I know. I know you hate caskets. I don't like them either. But I do like you, John. I know, John, but I have an idea.
You do? Okay. I guarantee you, it sounds good.
A classic. I will say
that rewatching this, I remembered this promo right away when it came on. Mm-hmm. This was one of the weirder promos, and Dave Lagana will share more on his interactions with Gene Snitsky and specifically John Heidenreich.
I wonder what the thought process was to create this. I mean,
well, based on this show, they were definitely going in the direction of Taker and Kane against Snitsky and Heidenreich, which a perverse side of me wanted to see. Yeah. It would have been Taker. It probably would have been Taker's worst Mania match outside of the Giant Gonzalez match, I think. But nonetheless, it did not happen. But what did happen, Way, is the casket match, which was up next between The Undertaker and John Heidenreich. The video here was fucked. I don't know what the storyline going on here was, but we saw Heidenreich in a straight jacket. Then we saw alcohol used to take out Taker. We saw a Jeep driven into a hearse. We saw a wax sculpture of John Heidenreich inside of a casket. And the gimmick is that Heidenreich hates caskets. Very original for opponents of The Undertaker. We've seen this with Kamala.
Yeah. How convenient. You hate caskets and you're
in a casket match. Why would you sign up for this?
Yes. But I thought it was a really well-edited video for what seemed to be a very
did not make me want to see this match. We go over to Michael Cole and Taz, who immediately take shots at Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler for being older and that both of them could be in caskets.
Yeah.
I felt that was a little mean-spirited.
Well,
it's one thing to say, oh, now the real team takes over. It's another to say these two could be dead soon.
That's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to have brain...
Insult their mortality rate?
Okay. All right, well, how was this match?
Michael Cole emphasizes at the start of this match that there will be no poetry. And I totally forgot. Heidenreich did a gimmick where he read poetry at this time.
Right.
He was a horrible, horrible character, I thought. From start to finish.
Well.
You were watching around this time, weren't you?
I was watching off and on. I wasn't watching too intently. What I remember about Heidenreich was A&E had this documentary about independent professional
wrestlers. Yeah, because he was one of Rick Bassman's guys.
And John Heidenreich was one of the guys featured. And you got to see Heidenreich in the light where he was really just this guy trying to make his dream come true. And now his dream has come true. He's involved in these stupid skits with Gene Snitsky.
Dream come true. So Heidenreich has cost Taker two chances at the WWE title, once at the No Mercy pay-per-view and once at the prior month's Armageddon event. So we get a very slow start with work with Taker working on the left leg of Heidenreich. Taker's then in the corner. Then he scoots up and applies a triangle that Taz identifies as such. And then Michael Cole refers to it as, quote, a triangle troke, which Taz does not let him get away with. He corrects him, and Michael Cole gets upset. Snitsky then runs in and attacks the Undertaker. And people reacted to this. They reacted to this like this was a big deal, and it led to a chant of Kane. And I thought I was in a parallel universe here, that people were invested in Gene Snitsky and the hope for a Kane running.
Well, think about the it was still maybe novel at this time to see a Raw guy come up for a SmackDown match. Maybe that's what they were chanting about.
See, as much as I look back at years past, I think the more time is removed, you look back on things more fondly. Mm-hmm. I still do not recall a time that a guy showing up on another brand was a big deal, no matter how important Gene Snitsky was.
Okay.
They go to.
So this was Snitsky's big mysterious plan that he alluded to earlier.
Yes. He was going to work with John Heidenreich. And they go to put Undertaker in the casket. They open up the casket way, and I guess this is where TNA got the idea multiple times in the last 2 months. Kane pops out of the casket. He was there the whole time.
No, he just vanished. He just, when he realized his brother needed help, he evaporated and, condensed into the casket.
Huge pop for Kane in this casket. And they fight off Snitsky and Heidenreich. Kane fights with Snitsky through the crowd, and this leaves us back with Taker and Heidenreich. Heidenreich is scared around this casket, and then Taker attacks and tosses him into the steps. Then Heidenreich runs the casket into the Undertaker on the floor.
I really like that spot. It just, all Heidenreich did was, he was pushing the casket up the ramp, and you're thinking, why is this guy doing it? Why is he pushing the casket away from the ring? And then Taker gets hurt and is resting just underneath the ring where the apron is. And Heidenreich just simply rushes the casket into Taker. The casket hits the ring, and Taker is perfectly safe at this point, being, taking up the space in between the apron and the ring. But it looked great and got the crowd ooing and aahing, so I like that.
Heidenreich then tried to apply a Cobra Clutch. Couldn't close the lid to put Taker in. Then Taker makes a comeback, and he delivers a drop kick onto the lid of the casket.
A leg drop.
A leg drop. Yeah. Yes, a leg drop onto the lid.
Yeah, another very good, pretty simple spot. It looked like it hurt a lot.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. This man has extensive hip problems, and this is why. I was going to deliver a guillotine leg drop onto a hard surface.
I was going to say for Heidenreich, but Taker does this every match. Well, not every match, but every big match.
This led to a holy shit chant.
Yeah, I thought it looked very impressive.
Taker looked fine here. Heidenreich then hit a version of the black hole slam that Cole sells as Taker delivering when he is selling the move. And Heidenreich then goes for a pinfall. And this is where this match started to fall apart.
That, I'm not really sure why. Perhaps it was his natural instinct to actually go for a cover. But if that was the case, he managed to save it by pretending that it was planned. And it happens to work out for his character of being an idiot.
I just thought between the combination of, this black hole slam was hit and Michael Cole thought the Taker was the one who delivered this move when instead Taker took the move.
No, but I couldn't tell either because Taker's been known.
And it was executed badly.
Yeah. Well, Taker's been known for doing that that running DDT, right? That running tornado DDT. And I thought it could have been that, but yeah.
Heidenreich then takes a really shitty looking choke slam with little height, then a tombstone, and Taker rolls him into the casket for the win. I wasn't a big fan of this match. I get the sense you enjoyed it more than I did. I thought Heidenreich just sucked.
I thought this match was a lot better than it had any right to be. There were some, like you said, the crowd was hot even for that Snitsky-Kane run-in.
Yeah.
And two very clever spots, I thought, with the casket and, a little sloppy towards the end, but I thought it was a lot better than I thought it was going to be.
Teddy Long then forced Eddie Guerrero to give the number back to Flair. Evolution then walks in, and Hunter says, "Give it up, Jumping Bean." And Eddie's response was just that, I don't think he appreciated that comment at all.
Well,
it's a very racist term,
not.
And I didn't That's get why. The effect that Eddie was responding in character. It was just like, fuck.
If you thought this was bad, you should have waited until a JBL segment later on tonight.
So he gave the number back, and then walked off. And then it leads
to... he gave the number back, and then Long says, come on, Eddie, there's more. You have to give me the
Right. He also had Flair's wallet, which he didn't realize was gone.
And then Flair's reaction when he realizes that he stole his wallet was just awesome. Flair just freaks out. He's like, what? My wallet? It was a fun segment between Eddie and Flair. And I can't get enough of those two together. Great.
Hunter then wants to go over plans for his match with Randy Orton, but Batista says he's just going to go draw his number and then come back. And they argue. Hunter says, no, we're going over the Orton match. And Flair then has to play peacekeeper and just calms them down. If you weren't watching WWF television at this point, this slow, simmering feud between Batista and Hunter was some of the best work WWE's done in the last decade, I thought. It was just so subtle that there was a collision coming between these two friends. And you knew it was happening. You knew it was going to occur. And they kept just teasing you every week. And I loved this storyline when it was happening. Just loved it. Eric Bischoff is then with Christian and Tomko in the room to draw numbers. And Teddy Long walks in. And this leads to John Cena coming in, acting extremely lame, saying hi to T-Long. Then he calls Bischoff Burt Reynolds. And Christian then proceeds to have a battle rap with John Cena, with Christian rhyming Transylvania with WrestleMania.
Yeah.
And then Cena...
it's such an easy rhyme.
Yes. Cena then just put him to shame with his own rhyme. And that was our backstage
segment. I thought Cena was very funny. I enjoyed the segment too.
And that leads us
to... But he didn't end up drawing a number. He just went in and did this thing and then walked out.
Yep.
My name is Christian, the King of Crunk. I'm taking you to school, Cena, and you're gonna flunk. I'm Captain Charisma. I'm Captain Charisma. Read 'em and weeps. I'm gonna throw you out for all my peeps. And just like Dracula comes from Transylvania, I'm winning the Rumble and going on to WrestleMania. What do you think of that, baby boy? Come on, beat that.
Captain Charisma, walking around with your fake smile, thinking you can rap just because you watched 8th Mile. Word on the street is your peeps are weak, and you and Blackbeard share a bed when you sleep. Yo, this is Chain Gang. We run the showdown. Tonight's like your sex life. Your ass is gonna go down. I go to the ring when my name is called. You can pick my number. You like playing with balls.
And that leads us to the WWE title match. JBL defending the gold against Kurt Angle and The Big Show in a three-way. They mentioned that JBL and Angle had a brutal last man standing match on SmackDown earlier that week. And they start with JBL and Big Show as Angle just stands on the floor, which if I was the agent putting together this match, that's the combination I would want, with Kurt Angle just being the spectator on the floor. We get Big Show and JBL here to start us, folks. But we can build.
Yeah. Big Show looked so fat here.
He was very
big. He looked huge, but I thought he was very well booked. I like him as a dominant monster in these multi-man matches. You saw it recently on SmackDown with that number one contenders bout. I find him to be very useful.
Angle entered the match after the first pin attempt by the Big Show. They fought on the floor. Angle actually went for a German suplex to the Big Show. He was unsuccessful. Show then attempts a chokeslam to JBL through the announce table, but Angle hits a low blow onto Big Show and then hits him in the head with a monitor, and this leads to Big Show taking a nasty plunge off of a chair through the announce table to briefly take him out of the match.
Is that what that move is called?
That's what... what are you supposed to call a guy free-falling backwards? That's what's always been referred to as. Mick Foley coined the term.
The Nesty plunge.
Because there was a Nesty commercial where the famous spot where he drinks and he takes a plunge
a Nesty
backwards.
Plunge.
Well, you come up with a better name. You come up, okay?
I won't.
The
Edjo plunge.
JBL and Angle then fight in the ring. JBL takes a series of German suplex until the Big Show comes back.
They referenced a little bit on SmackDown here with JBL having taken 8 German suplexes just on the SmackDown beforehand. And so in this match, JBL was trying really hard to avoid it.
This match sold me really well on the Last Man Standing match. That's what I wanted to see with all this. It sounded like it was a hell of a much better match.
Yeah. I really liked this match, though. I didn't think this was bad at all.
This match wasn't terrible. I
thought it was good. I thought they all worked a very good pace. Considering Big Show's size, I didn't notice that he was off at all.
There was a double team spot that looked really good where Kurt went to clip the knee of Big Show at the same time JBL hit the clothesline from hell. I really liked that spot.
Mm-hmm.
Show then put JBL through the barricade on the floor. This led to another holy shit chant.
Yeah, maybe this was one of the first times that they did that barricade spot that we talked about on Reveal Raw.
Angle then runs at Show with a chair, but he's lifted and dropped headfirst onto the chair in the ring. Then Mark Jindrak runs out, and he was aligned with Kurt Angle at this point, to pull the referee out and save Angle. And then Big Show goes after Jindrak. Orlando Jordan, meanwhile, who was part of the cabinet with JBL, comes out, lifts JBL, puts him into the ring. Then JBL delivers the clothesline from hell to a groggy Angle who's still selling the chair shot, and JBL sneaks away with the victory and retains the WWE title.
I enjoyed this match.
It didn't blow me away.
Okay, well,
they had some decent spots.
I thought
they only had like 12 minutes. The casket match got more time.
I know, and maybe that's why I liked it so much, because everything was just constant action. You know, obviously led by Kurt Angle, but JBL and the Big Show all kept their pace. Everybody was booked well, with good spots within, stories told within the match. And even the commentators did well, I thought.
Then we go backstage, and JBL is celebrating with the Bashams and Orlando Jordan and Amy Weber, who are all comprising the cabinet.
I think you're...
Did I skip something?
Yeah. Aren't we skipping that Batista and Carlito?
No, that was next.
Oh, never mind. Sorry.
So Batista is then approached by Carlito, and Carlito at this point was putting together a petition to have Teddy Long removed as the general manager from SmackDown. So Carlito comes up. They chat about Batista's physique, and then they talk about the petition, and Batista's not interested in signing it. So Carlito chews his apple, teases spitting it at Batista, but he is scared, and he walks off with Batista stating that he will take the petition and put it up Carlito's rectum. That is what it was alluded to.
Mm-hmm.
So Batista then keeps walking, and this was right out of Aaron Sorkin walk and talk here, as they followed him down the hallway into another room. This is pretty elaborate.
Aaron Sorkin walk and talk. I don't want to.
That was what
Aaron
he made
Sorkin
famous
shows
on the West Wing, where they would be on a dolly and just follow people as they would walk, like for 3-minute scenes, just to different locations.
There you go.
It wasn't just a cut to another scene.
Maybe he was guest directing this episode.
I don't think Aaron Sorkin was part of this rumble, but I could be wrong. He goes into the room to ask for his number. Bischoff and Teddy are arguing, and Bischoff states that Evolution is banned from ringside for the world title match tonight. And Batista says, well, I'll tell Hunter about that. And then we get the first WrestleMania 21 spot for that year's event, and it was a parody of Forrest Gump starring Eugene. And we'll find out a little interesting tidbit about Eugene during this commercial when we have Dave Lagana on later on. Suffice it to say, I really enjoyed this first promo. I remember when it aired, and everyone just... enjoying the spot.
Just shot, produced, directed, performed, and written so well.
Yeah. Woman was punched in the face, so for you Jericho China fans, I know you would have loved that. a very good cameo as well by William Regal.
Oh my God.
Very well done spot.
Yes. Watch it if you haven't.
And then we get a plug for the theme song, which I tortured you all with as we started this show. Find the Real by Alter Bridge.
I fast forwarded.
What a horrible song. And that leads us to the world title match, everybody. Triple H defending the title against Randy Orton.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to recap this feud, Orton had won the title at SummerSlam, which we reviewed a while back. And then the next night, we reviewed that SummerSlam.
I think so.
Yeah.
Toronto, right?
Yes. And then the next night, Evolution turned on Orton. Hunter won the title back very quickly. Then a few months later, the title was vacated. And 3 weeks before the Rumble, Triple H regained the title in an Elimination Chamber match. And that set up this rematch after Orton beat Batista in a number one contenders match on Raw. So this at one point was penciled in as the main event of WrestleMania. And When Orton turned babyface, there were a lot of factors working against him, and his stock dropped significantly at the same rate Batista's was rising. And essentially, Batista took the spot of Orton, and they had that pretty much decided upon going into this match.
Orton was much bigger at this time. He's not lean like he was now. He is considerably more muscular.
He was big, and he was playing the happy baby face, which is probably the worst role for Randy Orton possible.
Yeah.
Because he is not a happy man.
The crowd wasn't really taking...
not at all. This crowd was not an Orton crowd.
He just gave off a sense like he was being forced down people.
I think so. Mm-hmm. Hunter came out. Do you ever get these 1-888 numbers? Christ.
Yeah. Are they telemarketers? Answer.
Speaker. Hello? He's not here right now. Can you, I think he'll be home probably later on this evening. Thank you.
Well, who is that?
Scotiabank. I'm not even part of Scotiabank. Why are they calling me?
Okay.
Those fuckers will call you for like months on end.
You have to put your phone number on the do not call list.
I heard, though, that they're still selling those lists.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was reading about that. This one, we'll get back to the review in 2 seconds, but this 1-888 number called me for like 3 straight weeks. Uh-huh. And then one Saturday morning, they called me at 8 a.m., and I picked up the phone, and I just yelled at the woman. And she was this old lady. I felt really bad, but they didn't call again.
Wow.
That's how you get on the do not call list.
Yeah. Well, okay.
Answer angry. Okay.
That always works. I
better cut this out or leave it. Who cares? All right. Triple H against Randy Orton for the world title. Yes, we were talking about Hunter here, who, my God, was this man jacked. Mm-hmm. Holy Christ. First candidate for the Putski Award. And we're going to give out the Putski Award at the end of tonight because there were some viable candidates.
Okay. Let's remember to do that.
Yeah, we've kind of let it drop. But I have been every now and then updating the list info tab. So
great.
I haven't forgotten about it, folks. You can still nominate the Scott Putski Award, everybody, at WrestlingRadioAwards.com because they're going to be naming everything on January 30th. So go over there, and there's an option of an award to add next year. And this is our grassroots campaign to get the Scott Putski Award nominated.
Well, maybe that's somebody we can interview.
Putski. I want to build up to that one. That should be WrestleMania for us.
That would be.
Okay. Jim Ross brings up that only Ric Flair and Hulk Hogan have had more title reigns than Triple H. And sadly, I think that group has expanded exponentially in the last couple of years. I think Edge has like 5,000. Cena has about 62,000.
He's got 10 right now, doesn't he?
Is Cena at 10?
No, Edge.
Edge is at 10. Ridiculous. Early on, Orton goes for the RKO twice. The second one, he is countered and dumped to the floor. And basically, Hunter just lifted him and dropped him over the top rope, which years later they would do that spot, but Orton decided to take a back bump onto the floor and ended up breaking his collarbone.
Mm.
Not a good spot. Hunter then worked on the knee of Randy Orton, and the camera was right in Orton's face, and he was selling it, yelling, "Oh, shit! Fuck!
Shit! Shit!"
What a baby face.
Mm-hmm.
Hunter continues to wear down the knee. He used the figure four. Orton then finally kicked Hunter, and he went into the Spanish announce table, and then Orton made his comeback in the ring. We see a cross body off the top by Orton. I kind of wasn't a fan of this. Like, Orton was like, he kind of forgot that he was selling the knee at parts.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
Was just kind of, I thought Hunter did a fantastic job in this match, like calling this match and kind of carrying things. Because Orton, I didn't find Orton to be that great in this match.
I thought he was still very vanilla at this point.
Yeah. You got to remember, this guy was 24 at the time. Extremely young.
Yeah.
There's a pedigree spot, which is countered into a slingshot into the ropes. And then Orton goes for an RKO, which was also countered. Then Orton goes for a DDT, but Hunter stops him and knocks Orton down, taking a back bump, and they tease that he knocked the back of his head and he had a concussion. And this was the best-selling Orton did, to the point I almost thought he did like ring his bell here in this match, because his eyes look completely glazed at this point. Then Hunter runs into Orton and Earl Hebner into the corner. So Hebner's out, Orton's on the ground, selling this supposed concussion, and Hunter then grabs the sledgehammer, goes to find Orton, who drop toe holds him into the steel steps. Some great selling there by Hunter. And then they're back in the ring. Hunter just hits this giant clothesline and then lifts him up pedigree and gets the win. So they were really trying to sell this head injury. And again, I don't know if something actually happened in this match.
I doubt it.
I think it was just selling. But I enjoyed this match, to be honest. I thought Hunter was really, really good in this match.
Yeah, I thought this was okay. But I think it started to drag after a while due to the overbooking. You had so much in here. You had the leg injury. Then you had this confusing concussion thing that I didn't figure out. It just didn't seem to be able to build any sort of momentum because Orton would go for his comebacks. Then he'd get stopped. Then Triple H would go for it, and then he would get stopped. I thought there was just too much unnecessary back and forth and way too much
stuff. There was no point in this match where I ever bought Randy Orton as a credible challenger here to Hunter. And that doesn't have anything to do with the fact that this is an old show and you know the result. I just found Randy Orton as a babyface was just absolutely they made the right call in going with Batista over Orton.
Right.
Then we're backstage and Nunzio is just walking down the aisle talking to himself about being in the Royal Rumble, mm-hmm. which I'm sure every guy does. And he's holding his ball and just tossing in the air. And Kurt Angle grabs the ball and basically tells Nunzio to fuck off. His night is over.
Angle's a heel at this point, right?
Yes.
Okay.
He'd be a real shitty baby face.
Yeah, I wasn't sure.
So Angle now is in the Royal Rumble. Eric Bischoff then brags to Teddy Long about the recent title match we just saw. Teddy Long then advocates clean finishes about how they are much better when you don't have other guys involved.
You're right, I love Eric. The lack of interference made this match a lot better.
JBL then walks in with the cabinet who are celebrating. JBL just acts like a subtle racist here.
Oh, my God.
To Teddy Long. And Long then announces that JBL is going to be defending his title in 3 weeks at No Way Out in the first ever barbed wire steel cage match. And JBL is speechless here.
So Teddy Long says he's a fan of pure booking and then comes up with this double-decker gimmick for his main event.
He's got to sell a pay-per-view in 3 weeks. Why not? And then up next is the Royal Rumble, everybody. And they were running a little late here because this was like 2 hours into the show. Mm-hmm. So for the Rumble, we're going to get Jim Ross and Taz calling this. And Ross gets his own dig asking Taz, are you sure you can keep up? This is Raw. This is how we do it. And we start off the Rumble with Eddie Guerrero out number one and then Chris Benoit with the story that Benoit started the Rumble last year and won it and wondering if he can repeat this year.
Mm-hmm. Large chance for Eddie from this California crowd.
And large bodies from both of these men.
Yeah.
Very scientific back and forth, both mm-hmm. working for holds here. Huge Eddie chance. He was the most over guy, I thought, in this entire show.
Yeah, I'd say so. Sure.
Number three into the Rumble way, Daniel Pewter, mm-hmm. who is identified as the tough enough kid, Pewter, by Taz. And why don't you describe what he was wearing, Wei?
Was he not just wearing a t-shirt?
No, he was wearing...
What was he wearing?
He was wearing MMA gloves with, like, knockoff tap-out gear, but instead it said Pewter instead of the tap-out logo.
Okay.
And
well, that's his gimmick. He's an MMA guy.
He's an MMA fighter
who
looked like he was 100 pounds here in comparison to Benoit and Eddie. And he cuts a promo on being the first tough enough winner to win the Royal Rumble. And
joke of a promo.
Yeah, he just had go-away heat here.
Mm-hmm.
And then Benoit and Eddie proceeded to chop the shit out of Daniel Pewter. I remember watching this, and it was uncomfortable how they just murdered this kid.
Number
the
four.
Chops here were just ungodly.
Yes, and number four to arrive was...
if a guy's getting initiated... the last person you want coming down the ring is Hardcore Holly. And just before this, we saw Chris Benoit deliver a back suplex to Pewter, which looked very nasty in the drop.
Yeah.
So Holly comes in, and he asks Eddie and Benoit if he can take over here. And what we got then were three of the most disgusting chops I've ever seen to a human being by Holly, who continues to kill Daniel Pewter, and then hit an Alabama slam where Pewter's head bounced so far off the canvas that I think it hit the roof.
Oh, man.
This was so unprofessional. I don't care what people believe about initiations and this bullshit. This was so unprofessional. I hated this.
This was what what Jerry Lawler always tells us on Raw. If kids, if you're ever involved in anything that involves an initiation, just say no. Well, Daniel Puter didn't say no.
Oh, this was just unbelievable. And a lot of people are going, well, that's just the business. Well, that should not be the business. Number five is Hurricane Helms, and Benoit and Eddie just instantly then dump out Hardcore Holly. Then Helms is eliminated by a back body drop. And somewhere in all of this, Pewter was tossed out, I believe, by Holly?
Yeah.
Okay, so Pewter's gone.
And Holly tosses out Pewter, and then he gets tossed out.
So the gimmick is Benoit and Eddie are fighting, and when new guys would come in, they just beat him up and throw him out. Number six, Way, do you remember Kenzo Suzuki?
Of course I remember Kenzo Suzuki.
This guy was once going to have a main event title program with Chris Benoit, which sadly
right?
we never saw, the ill-fated Hirohito gimmick.
When I watched this, I think I couldn't believe that I was watching a tape from 2005 because this was a gimmick out of the 80s.
Yes.
But I guess in wrestling, everything, stereotypes still exist.
It did. This man had some of the most awkward movement I've ever seen from a wrestler.
He sucked.
He was really bad.
I was just thinking, if you wanted a Japanese guy to play this stereotypical Japanese character, why of all people in the world would you choose Kenzo Suzuki?
No clue. There was no shortage of guys that could have filled that role. Number seven is Edge, who comes in and delivers more chops. I had seen enough chops by the seventh entrant. Then Rey Mysterio is in. He delivers a head scissors to Kenzo and eliminates him. And then we had Shelton Benjamin, who was the Intercontinental Champion at this point. And Rey and Eddie worked together to eliminate Benoit, but they were unsuccessful. Booker T is then in. And during this entrance, we see Eric Bischoff come down to rally the Raw troops. And then we got Chris Jericho in number 11. Teddy Long was now out rallying the SmackDown troops.
I really felt at this point, with all the people in the ring, you could really see the discrepancy in talent of the roster between now and 6 years ago.
That was my next point.
Everyone in the ring at this moment, I mean, with the exception of Shelton Benjamin, was a main eventer, all had held world titles, all a ton of history and accomplishments.
I had this written down earlier about the talent you had in here. You had Benoit, Eddie, Ray, Edge, Jericho, Benjamin, Haas, Michaels, Angle. I mean, tons of just phenomenal talent. You could probably go up and down the list, and this was probably maybe even the most talent-heavy Rumbles they ever had. Like, just unbelievable depth.
It's not really a knock, though. I mean, we've accepted and realized that, you know, the past year has been a building year for the company.
For sure. So Luther Reigns was out 12. He was our next Scott Putski candidate.
Oh.
And Ross says that Luther Reigns can shock the world tonight, I'll say. Then we got a cool little spot, Way, because there were eight guys in the ring, four Raw guys, four SmackDown guys, and they ended up taking separate sides of the ring, and they just lined up against one another, and they waited just long enough for the crowd to click that this was Raw and SmackDown.
Oh, yeah, and you had Teddy out there, and you had Bischoff out there
This was a great spot.
It was a
and then they just attacked.
Visual.
Huge reaction.
Yep.
This was a great spot.
I love just... The Rumble is great for little surprises.
Just
like
little spots like that really set the Rumble apart. I really enjoyed that. Muhammad Hassan was number 13, and this kind of played the opposite, where you had all eight guys work together, that they hated Hassan. They stopped when he entered. They just beat the shit out of him when he got into the ring. Ray hit a 619, then they picked him up and dumped him over the top rope in less than a minute.
Perfect booking to follow up on the division of the brands. It was just very fun and memorable. I just love whenever you can tell stories without words, simply using positioning of guys in the ring and just using movements. It was great.
Orlando Jordan is then out next, and I don't know how much of his lifestyle was public to those backstage, but do you remember what his nickname was?
No.
The Chief of Staff.
Oh, okay. I don't know. I don't know if that
You don't
was...
think that was a double entendre?
Could have been a coincidence.
Maybe. There's always coincidences in wrestling booking. Scotty Too Hotty is out number 15, and he never made it to the ring. He was attacked by Hassan on the ramp, and then Hassan applied the camel clutch. So Scotty never made it into the ring. So I guess, was he ever technically eliminated?
Well, if you don't make it, then
I guess not.
I guess you are.
Then we got Charlie Haas. And at this point, Booker eliminated Luther Reigns, who failed to shock the world. Then Booker eliminated Orlando Jordan. He went for a spin-a-rooney, but as he did so, he was eliminated by Ray and Eddie. Mm-hmm. Number 17 was Rene Dupree, who was accompanied by Fifi the Dog. Another Scott Putski candidate, I thought.
Sure.
And this was a very young guy who I thought this guy was going to be a star eventually, because he was like 19 when he was called up to the main roster and never went anywhere. Mm-mm. He wrestles in Hustle and never really did much. And then the World's Greatest Tag Team did a backbreaker spot on Renee, and they had been separated on Raw and SmackDown, so that was kind of a nostalgia spot.
Yes.
Then Shelton leapfrogged to the top rope and just shoved out by Edge in a kind of hilarious spot. Simon Dean was out next, who warmed up on the floor. He was doing Hindu squats. And during this time, Edge eliminated Eddie Guerrero, who had been in from the start. Number 19 is Shawn Michaels. He eliminates Simon Dean right away. And as Eddie was leaving the ring, the entire arena just started chanting Eddie.
Yeah.
And I know they were doing the story, like, can Chris Benoit repeat? But to me, I would have left Eddie in for that length of time. Like, this crowd was so into Eddie.
Mm-hmm.
Michaels then eliminated Haas. Kurt Angle was in next, comes in, suplexed everyone except for Shawn Michaels. They go back and forth. Angle then takes the sweet chin music and is dumped over the top rope. This was probably the greatest 37-second Royal Rumble participation a wrestler has ever had.
Completely agree. On paper, this is already a fantastic pairing, so you really didn't need to do a whole lot of storyline. And something like the Rumble, you eliminated me, now I hate you and I want to fight you at WrestleMania. Something as simple as that worked so well for these two.
Yeah, this was the kickoff for their Rumble, or for their WrestleMania program, and I thought it was done very well.
Mm-hmm.
Number 21, for whatever reason, Jonathan Coachman was in this Rumble wearing a t-shirt that said, "I'm the coach, that's why."
Okay.
Try and find one of those.
Yeah.
Coach hits Benoit and then runs in fear. Mark Jindrak is out next. Kurt Angle comes back into the ring. He lifts up Michaels like he's going to slam him like Gray Maynard did to Frank Edgar, and ends up eliminating him over the top rope, then busted him open on the floor and applied the ankle lock. So great start to this program, and really made you want to see this. This was a match no one had seen before.
Yep.
They had never interacted.
Mm-hmm.
So you already had interest right away.
Mm-hmm.
Then we got Viscera, Paul London. Dupree then did his French tickler spot and is then tossed out by Chris Jericho.
Mm-hmm.
Then number 25 was John Cena, who had a huge pop when he came out.
Mm-hmm.
He had his U.S. spinner belt at the time and his classic t-shirt that said, "Ruck Fools."
Ruck Fools.
Because if you take the R and F and switch them, it says Fuck Rules.
Oh, I see.
That was the point of the shirt. 6 years later for us to do this podcast and have that reaction. So Taz cites Cena's pounding ground attack, which Ross would not copy, and he referred to it as ground and pound.
Mm-hmm.
Cena then hits a back body drop onto Viscera to eliminate him. Snitsky is out number 26, and we see a clothesline by Snitsky off of the apron to London, where Paul London sold this fantastic. He took this clothesline, and you describe it.
Well, he was basically, London was basically doing a shooting star press off of the apron onto the floor.
Yes.
The way he took this clothesline, he was just a back body, like a backflip.
And they took Paul London out on a stretcher here.
Mm-hmm.
They were really pushing Snitsky hard.
Yeah.
Kane was number 27. Kane just came in and chokeslammed everyone, but then he's dumped out by Mark Jindrak. Then number 28
was that who it was?
I think so, yeah.
Jindrak landed? Or was it not Michaels? Oh, wait,
Michaels
was
gone.
Or was it not Cena? I mean.
I believe it was Jindrak. Batista is then out next, who eliminates Snitsky. Big chant for Batista here. The crowd was definitely getting behind Batista, even though he was still pseudo-heel at this
Cena
point.
Cena took out Kane.
Okay, my mistake.
Yeah.
Then Batista hit a Batista bomb to Kane. He press slams Jericho out and eliminates him. Christian is number 29. And then Cena hit the FU to eliminate Kane. And then number 30 was Ric Flair, who tosses out Coachman. Batista then press slams Christian over the top rope. Batista then slams Benoit. And then Flair eliminates Chris Benoit. So they were telling the story that Batista did all the work and Flair got the credit for eliminating Benoit, who lasted over 47 minutes and was the longest guy in the Rumble.
Mm-hmm.
And they tease Flair and Batista fighting for a second. And then Edge dumps out Flair. And this led to boos from the crowd because this man was incredibly entertaining during this match.
Mm-hmm.
And the final four are Batista, Edge, Rey Mysterio, and John Cena. And we see Edge deliver a spear to Batista and Cena. Rey then goes to the apron, and Edge spears him to the floor. Cena and then Batista back body drop Edge out, and we're down to Cena and Batista. And both tease doing their finish with the Batista bomb and the FU. Batista then goes for the Batista bomb, lifts up John Cena. And what happened, Wei? Because I have no clue.
Well, Cena seems to be on top of Batista, and they just topple. Batista loses his balance, and the two of them fall out to the floor together with both men hitting the mat at the same time.
Like, this, they only showed this once, so I'm sure if you looked at the replay, it would not be as inconclusive. But watching this the one time, it looked great.
It looked like they had planned this, and I actually even wrote here that I thought they both executed this spot very well, with both of them hitting the mat at the same time off of that. At this point, the two referees from Raw, from both sides of the brands, Raw referees were saying that Batista had won, while the SmackDown referees had said that John Cena had won. Nothing at all seems at all odd about this.
No, not at all. They did the deal where first they lifted the arm of Batista, then the arm of Cena, to get reactions for both guys, kind of see who was going to get the bigger pop. I thought they killed time well here while they were trying to figure this out. Now, what was going against them here was they were racing against the clock here, and Dave Logano will get more into the specifics about what was happening backstage at this point, but suffice it to say, Vince McMahon, who is producing this show, runs down the ring doing the Vince walk, and upon entering the ring, blows out his quad. Ended up actually blowing out both quads before the end of the night, because he would get up later and put weight on it, blowing out the other quad. And so Vince gets into the ring, and he's sitting in the ring. You have no idea what's happening here. He's shouting out directions and calling spots, and Batista and Cena don't know what to do. So each takes a turn tossing the other one over the top rope. This is where I totally saw that as something that was not, it was clearly killing time, because I don't know why you would want to continually eliminate each other here. I thought it just,
that part definitely seemed improvised, because yeah. Nobody knew why. No. Vince McMahon was sitting down on the floor.
Yeah,
first
they
of all.
Didn't know at all. So then they order the match to be restarted after the double elimination, and then each eliminating one another. Mm-hmm. And this went about 16 seconds. They were that much against the clock. We saw Batista hit a spinebuster quickly and then eliminate John Cena clean. And Batista was your winner. You got the glory shot of him posing on the turnbuckle, and boom, they were out. So very rushed finish. But I thought they did the best with what they could here with this situation.
I got to say, Vince McMahon, man, that dude, he's got to be so tough to just sit out there with that face. He just kept like a very calm face when the guy's just torn his quad. Like, if you remember Kevin Nash, when he tore his quad, the guy just crumpled on live TV when he tore his.
And then this guy gets out of the ring, and he doesn't even want assistance.
Oh.
And ends up blowing out his other quad.
That's pretty amazing.
Like, the pain that man must have been in was just incredible. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about that more with Dave Logano, who was right there when all this was going on backstage. Mm-hmm. And the fallout of that injury that would be affecting television production for the next couple of months. So a lot of interesting stuff there. But that was the Rumble 2005 mm-hmm. way. And I thought this was a very good show. I gave it a 7 out of 10. I really enjoyed the Rumble. Mm-hmm. And I liked the Hunter Orton match. I wasn't crazy about the casket match. And the opener with Michaels and Edge was good. I don't think at the level that you would expect to be the best match those two could have, but still a very good match. I really, really enjoyed the Rumble.
I give it a 7.5. I also really like this Rumble. Looking at this card on paper, I had so little interest, and my expectations were so low, like with a Heidenreich and Undertaker. But you know what? Everything exceeded my expectations. I really enjoyed that three-way between Angle, Big Show, and JBL. And the Rumble was very well booked, with a lot of comedy, fun comedy spots with Peter and Hassan. Michael's Angle match was built pretty well. And just no duds on the show at all. I enjoyed it.
So for more information now, we're going to chat with David Lagana, who is the producer for Ring of Honor Wrestling, and as well has just launched his own blog, iwantwrestling.com. So we got to chat with Dave a bit about the Royal Rumble 2005 event that he was a part of, and we're going to air now a portion of that interview, so check it out. Joining us, everybody, a very special guest. Always a great time having this guy on the show. He is Ring of Honor producer David Lagana, who's joining us from Philadelphia. And my first question, Dave, is what is the weather like in Philadelphia in comparison to Los Angeles in January?
Horrible, but I'm used to it. I've come here now in the last, I think, like 16 times in the last 2 years. And I grew up here, so it's kind of like living in Toronto. If you don't like it, it'll get colder in 2 minutes.
That's the thing. You just... After the continual winters, you kind of just get immune to the entire winter problems. But I guess you're a veteran now for the California folks out there.
It's like being a porn star. You're just ready to get pounded.
A great start to this interview. Every week on Review Away, we look at a classic event, or maybe not so classic event some weeks. And this week we were taking a look, Dave, at the 2005 Royal Rumble, which, of course, you were right there in the middle of things during that time period with the WWE on the SmackDown brand, I believe. And that was the night that Vince McMahon, we saw a crazy finish where Batista and John Cena both eliminated themselves. Vince McMahon then stormed out, tore both of his quads. It was one of the most surreal finishes to a pay-per-view. And I wanted to get some of your thoughts, if you can go back that far, of just how chaotic it must have been backstage that night with all of that going on towards the end of the pay-per-view.
Well, it was a very weird time anyway. I mean, that's when people ask me what the turning point in that company is as far as, you know, when things started to, you know, change a little bit for me. It was, you know, when Vince tore his quads because he, you know, he wasn't around as much for a couple months. I mean, he basically was out of it. We didn't see him from the Rumble till that WrestleMania. I mean, he was basically working from home. I think we saw him maybe once or twice. But, yeah, that night was crazy for a couple different reasons. That was also the kickoff. We were going to do the Rumble show, and then I think it was the first Super Show the next day. I think it was the very first Super Show that was ever done. And then we were going to go to fly to Japan.
Yes.
The next day, and we were going to be in Japan for a week. And then... I think, and personally aside, it was also the year the Eagles were in the Super Bowl, so I remember, you know, rushing home to watch the Super Bowl game after being in Japan. But, you know, it was a strange week before that even happened. And here is poor Stephanie, who was thrust into a job that she, you know, I think she admittedly wasn't really ready for, because, again, you prepare for a job. Like, Hunter's being prepared to groom and take over. Here's Stephanie on a day's notice. Here's her father having to go, you know, have very major surgery done to his legs, and she's got to go to Japan and produce, you know, this television product. It was a crazy night, and what happened was, and I believe Batista got his bell rung, so whatever the move he was doing, I don't know if it was a power bomb or it was electric chair, he just lost his balance, so he went over the top rope with Cena, and thankfully they both sort of hit at the same time. I mean, I don't remember the live cut, but you know, I don't think they showed a replay if it showed that, you know, either one of them hit first. But, you know, it was Vince. I believe Vince had called for, you know, Teddy or Bischoff, who weren't around. So he just got up right at, because he'd been sitting at that table and he hadn't warmed up. You know what I mean? And the man, it just popped. And it was, you know, it's surreal because I think I was getting ready to shoot a DVD extra or whatever, a web extra or something, what we were doing at the time. And, you know, we're just, why is Vince sitting on the ground in the ring? Because, you know, we weren't, you know, you're kind of doing three things, and you look and wonder why the boss is sitting on his butt. You know what I mean? Did someone knock him in it down? You know, it's like, and then, you know, it just kind of snowballed. And I remember being at the building for at least an hour or two before we even knew what was going on afterwards. And then we just got in a car, and I think we drove from, it was Fresno to San Jose, where we were doing the TV the next day. And it was just, you know, it was the most chaotic 2 days that I remember working in that company.
So, Dave, are you telling us that the finish originally was not supposed to be that? It was supposed to be...
Nope.
What was the original finish of that match supposed to be?
It was a Batista eliminating Cena.
Wow. Unbelievable. And this,
well, if you go back and look at the time, too, I believe that we were pushing time on it as well. So there was a fear of, you know, basically, and it's happened a couple times this past year. I think SummerSlam was the most recent, you know, where the event, it was, you know, 52, 53. You have to be off the air by 55. Mm-hmm. I think it's dead at the drop dead latest. I think that happened at WrestleMania, too, in Texas. You know, you have to be off the air. So, you know, this was the quickest solution. But, yeah, that was not supposed to happen.
Well, I think it's incredible that everybody involved with that whole scene, including Cena and Batista and the referees, managed to come up with something that seemed to fit the script perfectly at that time.
Yeah, I think, and if my memory serves me, I think Vince was out there when they were doing the thing where they were throwing each other over the top rope.
Yeah.
So I think Vince was actually calling this. This is how amazing a man he is. Here he is, he's torn his quad. He's sitting on his tuchus, as he would like to say, in the ring, and calling these spots, you know what I mean, and still creating a pretty memorable thing. You know, it's pretty close to that Brett Luger one in Providence in 93, 94.
Which I was
at when I was in college. But, yeah, I mean, that was – it was to understand how surreal it was, yeah, I mean, I think the DVD extra shoot was Batista. And it was just like what I had was like, all right, well, that's – we got to change that now. So it's – That's the theater aspect of the business is it's live. You know what I mean? Every time I say that this is a live product, if something happens, you have to adjust to it. You know what I mean? Like if Cena would have hit first or Batista would have hit first and it would have been clear, I don't know how she could have fixed that. Mm-hmm. It just happened that they both luckily hit at the same time.
It's amazing.
Now, at that point in time, Dave, a lot of people had been seeing Randy Orton had turned babyface a couple months earlier. People thought that it would be Hunter Randy going into WrestleMania. By this point at the Rumble, was it guaranteed that Hunter Batista was going to be the WrestleMania match and that was the direction? Or did things at all change after the Rumble, as you can recall?
No, I think it was always supposed to be Batista from I'm trying to remember where the spot was. I think it was – there was an Elimination Chamber before that with Hunter.
Yes,
I think it had been decided. I don't know if Batista was in the match or the electric chair spot that had been set up with Randy. And I think – I remember Hunter was, on Batista's shoulders. You wanted him to do it. And it was all kind of – I mean, that was probably the best – and again, goes to, you know, what's kind of not happening right now with wrestling is – well laid out story points that, you know what I mean, that make it worth your while investing in watching a TV show. If you watched Raw 4 weeks ago, nothing that you invested in 4 weeks ago is really kind of paying off now. You know what I mean? So like that's where that storyline picked up. So yeah, Batista had been in place at least through Survivor Series of that year.
That storyline, I just remember, it was just so great because it was so simple and you knew where it was going. You knew that Batista was going to turn babyface, but you didn't hear people saying that, oh, this is going to be so predictable. It was a constant build each week so that when he finally called out Hunter for the Mania match, there was this giant pop and everyone was so into that feud and they stuck with it for about 6 months of just these subtle teases where Batista would look at him an odd way. And it just kept building and building. And I thought it was just such a great build for WrestleMania that year.
Yeah, I mean, it's anticipation. It's the equivalent of, well, you know Rocky's going to beat the Russian at the end of Rocky IV. Why don't we swerve him, have the Russian win, and then make him come back and see Rocky V? No, I mean, it's, you know, there's, I think we live in a hypercritical world, especially, you know, with instant access to information and everyone now has a voice. But as storytellers, and I wrote an article about storytelling last week as well, which has a good screenwriting book recommendation in it if anybody's, you know, an aspiring screenwriter. It's a book called Save the Cat. Every story is basically the same, and your creativity in how you tell it is kind of the skill to it. And so, yeah, I mean, the Batista story is not anything new, but it was told so well, and the players are good, and Hunter played an excellent role, and Flair was great. And Dave was made on that story. You know what I mean? Dave Batista was basically rode the crest of that wave of being over from that one story for years. You know what I mean? Until he did his heel stuff that last year, you know what I mean? The most memorable story that he did was that one with Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Dave, on the other brand, we had John Cena really starting to build momentum as a superstar for the company. Can you just talk about the evolution of his gimmick and just going from being a Vanilla Ice parody on a Halloween special edition of SmackDown to a career-making gimmick for one of the biggest stars in the wrestling industry's history?
Yeah, John's character evolution was one of patience and, again, something that I think is severely lacking. Is where John, you know, the Vanilla Ice thing was a shot in the dark. You know what I mean? Let's try it. And, you know, and then even after that, it wasn't until we did that thing with Brock Lesnar where Brock took his knee out, I think, and he was out for, quote-unquote, 6 weeks, and it was just like, well, you know, we're in WrestleMania build. There's nothing he's going to be able to do for now. So, but we knew Brock was going to be champion after. Let's have him cut promos on Brock, even if we do another TV match. And John just... You know, every week John and I would just go shoot a different thing, and I'd give him a location and just some ideas, and you know he'd come back with these raps, and we made them cool. And I mean, I think they made a whole DVD out of all these raps we did that first year, that just made him unique. Now, granted, he had to evolve from that, but what was consistent was he just did it every week. He was cool. He was somebody you wanted to tune in and watch. It was something different. And then when by the time he turned babyface, he was only from, and my timeline may be wrong, but from when he started rapping, that October of 2002, to he turned babyface, I think in November of 2003. I mean that's a strong, you know what I mean? Like, when's the last time anybody's been elevated that quickly? And then and then where he's taken off to from there? I mean, John Cena has to be, I guess, the character of that decade as far as, you know, going from over and then longevity as well. And it's all started because there was patience to not turn him too quick or beat him too quick or, you know, and even when, like, I remember when he wrestled Taker that first time, you know, everyone was like, oh, Cena's got to win. But it was patience to know that, like, this guy's going to get there and don't give up on him. Keep, even though he lost to Taker, he still came back and was still the same edgy guy. And that's the point, is you got to keep focus on someone. Even if they lose, keep focus on them and keep pushing them, so to speak.
Now, when you guys go into the Rumble, I mean, for that year especially, it's a perfect example where you could definitely make the case for Batista going over or Cena going over. I mean, both were really, really hot at that time period. Was it something where it was weeks in advance, everyone knew Batista was going over? Or when it comes to the Rumble, I mean, are cases made from each brand and the creative staff about who has more upside? I mean, what's kind of the thought process of who is going to be going over in the Rumble, specifically when you have the two brands?
It was always kind of a push and pull thing. I mean, the Rumble match itself is constructed with a very small group of people, and you know, the last couple of years I got to help with the organization of it and you know, get a couple spots in and stuff. But like, it's 3 to 4 people most putting it together. Basically, they know who the winner is and any particular spots or any stories that want to be told. But you know, it's put together by a very small select group. And It's one of the most unique events because there's so much creativity and flexibility that can go into it. That year specifically, I don't remember a lot about, you know, why or what. I remember there was some discussion over, was the right move to end with Cena and Batista, because Cena would end up going on to WrestleMania, and how did that make John look, mm-hmm. you know, having been thrown out, and, you know, were you hurting one baby face to help another and all that stuff? And I think in the end, you know, what ended up happening was, you know, was good, but you know what I mean? I think in the end, no one really, it didn't hurt either one of them because they both were on such a rocket ship. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting process because how do you spotlight 30 guys, now 40, you know what I mean? And make everyone look good. Well, you can only make certain guys look good. And you know, it's basically everyone knowing their role, which is the secret to all pro wrestling, because everyone needs to quote unquote know their role.
Dave, I also want to talk about the WWE's unique advertising for this event. We saw with this and also along with WrestleMania 21, the following two pay-per-views, we saw a very unique brand of advertising with the West Side Story parodies and then all those brilliant Hollywood parodies that everybody still remembers very fondly. What was the genesis of those ideas and how was production handled for all of those?
I'm trying to remember the a lot of the promo, like that West Side Story one, I think that was not the infamous TNA invasion.
Yes.
Of the West Side Story shoot, where they brought balloons and stuff, and I think that was that shoot. I don't remember.
Yeah,
exactly,
I think it was. I think you're right.
You know, like, that's just, you know, they have a great promo department that I think is still run by John Gaborik. I haven't worked there in 3 years, so I don't know exactly who's still in charge of what. But you know, they used to come up with these great campaigns, and I don't think they do it as much anymore because of, you know, budgetary restrictions and stuff. I'm sure the first place to get cut was promos because, you know, while creative, you can't point and say, well, this sold buys. So, but that one was great just simply from the fact that I think Hardcore Holly had to wear greaser hair, or maybe he was the one that didn't have to have hair done or something. It was funny stories that came out of that. And the guys, if you go back and watch that commercial, you see the guys who were featured, or I think it was JBL was the only one who didn't need wardrobe. His clothes actually matched.
Oh, yeah, for the Few Good Men one, yes.
Yeah, and then the Hollywood stuff was great because, you know, it was a chance to really kind of, you know, play upon a theme, and themes work, mm-hmm. especially, you know, WrestleMania. I think it was WrestleMania Goes Hollywood or whatever the thing was, because the set matched it and stuff. And then that's, you know, I felt like the last couple of WrestleManias, it's just these giant sets, which are great, but you know, the theme that WrestleMania, I think that WrestleMania one was kind of my favorite theme because the everything looked right. It just felt like a big show because, again, it wasn't at a big arena. It was the Staples Center, but it had this great theme to it. And it, those vignettes were great. I mean, the I'm trying to remember Eugene with the box of chocolates one, which, you know, a little story there is he had torn his quad, I think. He had done something. He had got hurt really bad. And if you go back and watch that video, he was sitting on the bench. You never actually see him get up. He had been so hurt, but he still toughed it out to work that vignette and wherever. And, you know, and I'm trying to remember some other stories from those. But, I mean, we just, you know, Brian Gortz did a lot of the writing on those, and we all kind of pitched in, pitched some ideas. And, you know, the When Harry Met Sally one with Kurt and Christy Hemme was funny, and A Few Good Men was really good, and I'm sure I'm missing a couple off the top of my head.
I always loved the Braveheart one with Hunter, and Ric Flair just made that spot.
Yeah, Ric Flair on the donkey was hilarious.
Oh, man.
And, you know, it just, it what always works with the brand is, I think it was the predictable characters in unpredictable situations. No, unpredictable characters in predictable situations is kind of the thing. Is like the idea of what would, you know, if Ric Flair was in Braveheart, you know, your mind just immediately goes to it being good. And these ideas of parodying these great movie moments, you know what I mean? But with the WWE slant was really good. So
was there ever any hesitation or criticism from anyone in the company about I mean, it's kind of silly to say at this, you know, in this decade, but about breaking kayfabe in a lot of these vignettes.
No, because I think it's entertainment based. You know what I mean? I never have a big issue with something like that because, now granted, John Cena and you know, JBL had a match that year, but I think when that thing started airing, they had, you know, we hadn't even started the build to it. But I mean, it's all kind of, it's the equivalent of, you know, the Ultimate Fighter stuff. You know, these guys, the fact that now these fighters are saying that oh, I don't really hate this guy, we did it to build up the match, who's fake? You know what I mean? Like, everything on television is fake as far as I'm concerned. You know what I mean? Like the whole Jets, Patriots, you know what I mean, bad-mouthing stuff, that was all built to get people interested in the game. You know what I mean? It's all mental to get people, us all excited. So I don't worry about it. It's all entertainment. Everything is entertainment.
Speaking of Ultimate Fighter, Dave, it was 2 weeks before this event that the Ultimate Fighter actually launched on Spike immediately following Raw. Was that on anyone's radar at that time? I mean, was that even really discussed at all when it first debuted? Because it did tremendous numbers right out of the gate and taking a large part of that Raw audience right after the show.
Yeah, I know there's been a lot of the talk, especially, you know, in looking back at that time period, and I don't really remember exactly, but I think there was a way for Vince to put his foot down and not let it be there, but he didn't for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't remember exactly discussions. That's kind of, those three letters are really kind of very taboo in that company, you know, from the fact of, like, when I used to bring up, well, you know, as their buy rate started to escalate in 2007, you know what I mean, looking at what was working for them was the split attractions, where WWE in 2007 went to everybody on every pay-per-view every month. I think it was 2007. So now John Cena went from being on 8 pay-per-views a year to 14.
Yeah.
And that just started to dilute it. And basically we were doing, you know, first, you knew every if Taker was wrestling, you know, Edge, you knew that first match was, you were going to get a screwy finish because you knew they were going to come back with a second, third, fourth one. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's really helped dilute the product, as opposed to going, all right, Taker and Edge is going to main event this month, John Cena will do the next month, and that's kind of where UFC's model is they don't, Brock Lesnar isn't fighting on every pay-per-view, and it now lets the fans choose and pick, but it has also built out their base.
Well, Dave, I want to thank you so much for chatting with us. This has just been excellent. And my final question before we let you go is that, as well on this Royal Rumble event, there was an infamous promo that I don't know if you recall, but I definitely remembered it as soon as it came on. And that was the one involving Gene Snitsky and John Heidenreich and the beginning of this proposed alliance. And it seemed after this show that we were going to get Undertaker and Kane against Snitsky and Heidenreich. And unfortunately, the world was never able to see this great tag match. What happened here?
Was that the breathing one where they just...
Yes, where it ends with...
I don't remember.
Oh, my gosh. This promo.
I remember the promo, and I remember the parodying that has happened since. And those are actually two of my favorite characters. Like,
I thought as a like second match in, these two would have become such a great babyface tag team. I totally thought
John Heidenreich is just probably one of the most insane human beings I've ever met in my entire life. And Gene Snitsky is one of the most unique human beings I've ever met in my entire life. You know, it... in 1986, they would have been a great tag team to go against the Road Warriors.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just, I just remember the breathing. I'll just say that. I'm pretty sure I didn't produce that one, but I have no idea. I don't really remember, but well, I mean, it's just like Heidenreich and Michael Cole. It seems like everything with Heidenreich always kind of leaned towards that,
yes,
that really weird, area. So,
well, Dave, before we let you go, we'll, promote what's coming up next weekend. You guys are going to be at the Hilton LA Airport Friday, January 28th, part of Wrestle Reunion. We're going to have Roderick Strong, El Generico for the ROH title. And then, of course, the 9th anniversary show that is the next internet pay-per-view from Chicago Ridge, which I'm looking forward to. And then you guys are back in our neck of the woods coming up in May. So lots of stuff to check out. And I guess people can go online to iwantwrestling.com, ROHwrestling.com to get their David Lagana fix.
Oh, please.
We want more Lagana.
At Lagana on Twitter.
You must be the only one, but it's okay.
Oh, come on. And a companion for every Raw broadcast I find. See, up in Canada here, they air 15 minutes later. So if I'm on Twitter, it's like everyone's tweeting like 15 minutes ahead of what we have to, of what we're watching here on the Score. So it's difficult for us Canadians, what these WWE.
Yeah, I don't know how West Coasters do it. I mean, see, I have DirecTV, so I get the show at 6. You know, otherwise I'd be like, that's what I'm talking about. We're a live culture. Like, tape delay, it's just going to die. It really is.
That was Dave Lagana, everybody, adding a lot of interesting facts to this Royal Rumble 2005 event and all the circumstances going on behind there. A fantastic memory he has for a lot of the interesting details that were attached to that event. So we ended up chatting with Dave for about a half hour. So that whole interview will be up at liveaudiowrestling.com in the podcast section, and it'll also be on iTunes. So your best bet, just go to lawradio.podbean.com/feed, and you can download it directly from there, because we're still having some issues with the podcast section, everybody. So just go to the Podbean site. And while I mention Podbean, I want to thank everybody. This past week, we were the number one sports podcast on that entire site. So that's a huge thank you to all of you listeners. And we're also right now leading all the other sports casts for the month. So some great numbers we're getting on Podbean. So thank you very much for that.
We're beating that football show.
Oh, yeah. The fantasy football thing is a monster.
Yeah.
So thanks, everybody. And for more on Dave Lagana, you can check out his blog, iwantwrestling.com, as well for info, ROHwrestling.com. Their show airs Monday nights, 8 and 11 Eastern on HDNet.
Also, at Lagana on Twitter.
Yes, a great guy to follow on Twitter, at Lagana. So lots of stuff coming up, and they're going to be at the Wrestle Reunion show next Friday, doing a show Friday night if you're in Los Angeles, which I know some of you are out there, such as Chris.
That's
and
right.
Milo. So we will now get into our feedback way, and we got a bit of it here, and we'll first chat about the Rumble 2005. Sorry, what are we going to do? How much do you want to do here?
Let's just handle the Royal Rumble and the all the
Rumble 05 and 2000
and Knucklehead.
Let's do that. Okay, and then we'll do the rest tomorrow. Cool.
Yeah.
So we'll get into it here. This one is on the Rumble 05 from Daniel Markey. Hey, glad to hear you're reviewing Royal Rumble 2005. It's probably my favorite Royal Rumble match, with Benoit and Eddie starting things off. The setup for HBK and Angle at Mania. Everybody in the ring stopping when Muhammad Hassan entered the ring, and everyone beats the shit out of him. And the battle of Raw versus SmackDown during the match, not to mention the famous no from Tomko when Christian says, "Give me a beat." Yes, that was during their backstage vignette, a very entertaining one.
Yes. Some feedback from Royal Rumble 2000, which we reviewed a couple weeks ago. Tom Williams, Royal Rumble 2000 takes me back. I used to be a huge Mick Foley fan. I love the Cactus Jack transformation when Mankind walked down the ramp and Hunter basically crapped himself as Mick took a layer of clothing off. I would love to see you guys review the No Way Out that followed this Rumble, as it was a Hell in a Cell match before they made it bigger and more safe. Do you guys consider video games? A review of the WWF No Mercy would also be rather epic.
We'll definitely, I think, at some point do a video game review. I wanted to do an N64 one. The problem is I don't currently have my system, and I don't know where it is. So as soon as I can find that, we will definitely.
I've had offers from people to lend me their N64 systems.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, maybe we can work something out where you can borrow one and we'll...
I don't know how it would really work, though. How are we going to review this video game?
I think we can just add some notes and our thoughts on the game. Just play it for like an hour or something. I think that would be so feedback heavy.
Yeah, a lot of people have asked for it.
I think people would love to chat about video games.
Yeah.
So one of these days we'll do a video game review because I think our audience would really dig it. And I'd love to do one. I think it'd be something different.
We'll create ourselves. And that, upload it.
Yes, that's what we could do. Jordan Ducharme. The Royal Rumble 2000 was my first pay-per-view ever that we ordered. My dad and I watched it when I was 10, and I've never felt more horrible and awkward than during the swimsuit competition. Also, there are no foggy doubts or memories in my head. Mae Young was fully topless, and they showed them on live pay-per-view.
Oh.
Probably the first pair of tits I'd ever seen in my life.
Oh, no.
Well, that's disgusting, Jordan. I feel for you. Being 10 years old, watching that with your dad, that must have been awesome.
Yeah. And you're broken in by Mae Young.
Gross.
Mark, that probably scarred you for life. How can you enjoy the naked female body after that? Mark Robinson. Actually, to correct John, Royal Rumble 2000 was not Taka's last appearance with the WWF. He was in the Hardcore Invitational at WrestleMania that year, as well as appearing on Raw 1 week in a match with Triple H. He and Funaki also regularly appeared on Heat well into 2001, a lot of the time doing their dubbed voiceover Evil or Indeed gimmick.
Yes, you are correct there. Alex Watts. I used to have a VHS of the event WWF Capital Carnage 1998, and I remember this part when Jacqueline got her top ripped off, and you saw it all. Ha ha. But why wouldn't they edit that? Probably because that spot was planned.
Yeah, but they wouldn't edit it off the VHS afterwards.
Why would they?
Because you're selling it. I mean, because
that's probably the biggest selling point of this random Capital Carnage VHS.
Don't they have ratings? Don't they have...
Maybe it was rated MA.
Okay.
I don't know.
Carmine Laveri. Royal Rumble 2000 was a great review. I had just recently been going through all the old Rumbles, and although the Battle Royal itself was not the best that year, it still had the legendary Cactus Jack Triple H street fight and the great tables match, even if the latter was a little shadowed. By the two awesome ladder matches that came before and after. Awesome job hosting the Law Way, and keep up the good work, guys. Well, thank you.
Yes, Way did a great job. Brian Kwan. This was my very first pay-per-view I ever watched, and I thought it was excellent. I was a real mark back in the day and wanted Triple H to lose so badly, but that never happened. However, I popped huge when Mick kicked out of the pedigree, but then felt disappointed when the second one happened. In addition, I remember vividly when Mae Young took off her top, the censorship was delayed, and you saw the boobs for a good few seconds, and they were hideous.
Justin Foe. It's a shame that a show that hosted both a great tag team tables match and street fight is ultimately remembered for an elderly woman flashing an audience.
It's the thing everyone seems to remember from that show. Amanpal Singh Mukar. I was only 10 when this was on, and let me tell you, I was scarred for life, these 10-year-olds. When Mae Young said that she was going to show us her puppies, me and my brother were like, nah, that's not happening. Unfortunately, we were so wrong. There was no covering on her, John. She was fully exposed. Like you, we both ran out of the room screaming. After we thought it was over, we came back and were happy to see that Mark Henry was holding her away from the audience. But that didn't last long. When they announced her as the winner, she ran around the ring in victory while we started screaming again. Terrible. We were eager to see the cat topless again, and instead we got this. Fuck my life.
No, wow. Oh, man. Finally, about the Royal Rumble, we have Liam Flynn. I really enjoyed last week's review of the Royal Rumble 2000. I have really great memories of the show, as at the time, I was the biggest Triple H fan. I also couldn't believe my luck when you played my favorite arcade fire track at the end of the show. It's really good to hear your opinions on things. It's where I'm from in England. It's hard to find people interested in pro wrestling. And it's also interesting that the English podcasts I listen to have a very different opinion to the American and Canadian shows. Maybe it's just a coincidence.
Do you think he's subtly trying to say that the British fans are much more optimistic and
I don't think so.
Complimentary, and it's we're just jaded pricks.
I don't think so. I think we're just different.
All right. Some comments on Knucklehead that we reviewed last week. Mark Cardoso states, "I saw both movies and one of the select few non-paying people who saw Knucklehead. That movie wasn't funny at all, and I actually felt bad for Big Show when he got stuck in the bus crapper, which is a sure metaphor for this movie. As for Legendary, leave it to the WWE to have entrances for an amateur wrestling final match. Wonder how Kurt Angle's Legendary / Karate Kid movie Beyond the Mat will be."
Perhaps we'll review that someday.
Yes, maybe we will.
Jay Hunter, the head nun says that it's horrible that the orphanage would close because the kids would all be put in foster homes. Surely that's a good thing and actually the whole point of an orphanage. I expected Big Show's knockout punch to be a big deal in the movie since WWE have been pushing it strong for years now.
And Richard Lee writes, hey guys, great job on the knucklehead review. Got it just after it was posted and woke everybody else up with my constant laughing and realizing that there will always be horrible movies made by wrestlers, which leads me to this question. I've heard rumors that Gene Snitsky is making a sequel to one of the worst movies ever. Manos. Is that how you say it? The Hands of Fate. By the way, check it out. It is that bad. Could you ask and check if this is true? Okay, we will try and find that one out.
Uh-huh.
Before we end off, Way, I wanted to add two more.
Okay.
And these, I'll read these ones because they come from Wei Ting's Facebook page.
Oh, I know which one.
Which I happen to see here. And I couldn't avoid these two. First from Scott Inman. Review of Raw is the best thing to listen to when you're sitting next to a drunk person on the subway here in New York City. They keep talking and talking and you just nod your head and just hope he does not puke before you get off the train. But the real big one, Wei, is from Sean Prasad. Here's a story for you. 2 weeks ago, I was walking home from work. It was about 1:30 in the morning. I was listening to the Review of Raw podcast when all of a sudden some guy in front of me told me, give me your wallet or I will stab you. I told him I didn't have any money. I really did. So he told me that he wanted the iPod then. I kept stalling, hoping a car or a person might walk by, but only a taxi drove by and did nothing. The joy of living in Scarborough. I ended up getting in a fight with this guy, but couldn't get the iPod back because he ran off. I wonder if this is a fan now of The Law, Review Away, Review a Raw, Review an Impact, and the Bite podcast.
That is an amazing
story,
Sean.
That is nuts, everybody. And
wow. Well, I'm glad you're okay.
And please, everybody, if you're ever in that situation, give up the iPod. Don't ever try and, as much as you might enjoy some of our podcasts,
yeah,
please. Don't put yourself in harm's way.
Yeah,
we are definitely not worth that at all.
No.
And thankfully, Sean is okay. So just a warning to those out there to be safe when listening to our podcast.
Yes.
So that brings us an end to
And
this.
Hello to our new listener, the guy who robbed Sean.
If he's listening. Turn yourself in. So, Wei, as we end this off, let's look ahead to next week. And okay. What would you like to review? As it's your decision.
Well, next week we'll be heading into the month of February, and as somebody suggested, I would like to look at Mick Foley's next match following the Royal Rumble 2000 with him at No Way Out against Triple H in the very memorable Hell in a Cell match.
All right, we will be reviewing No Way Out 2000 coming up next week. And some music to go out with, everybody. I will. I'm kind of stealing Way's gimmick here by not having something prepared ahead of time. So let's go out with a tune. What would be an appropriate tune?
What about? Let me think about the past hour. What we've discussed.
I thought of like a theme, something from West Side Story, but no one wants to hear that. I don't want to hear show tunes.
No. Well, what was your favorite song from 2005? Bring yourself back to that era.
Well, you know what? 2005.
Yes.
I believe that was the year. Who cares? It was 2004 or it was 2005 where we got the remix of California Dreaming, which is where Royal Rumble 2005 took place, by the Royal Gigolos.
Fuck.
This is an awesome remix, everybody, and that's what I want to go
with. Oh, God.